Welcome to UBC Insiders On Air for the week of October 2nd, 2015, the show that brings you incisive commentary, interviews, analysis, and the best-informed rumor mill around on UBC campus life and politics. You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasted from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver. My name is Mayan Kreitzman.
And I'm Neil Janssen. You can always check out our website, ubcinsiders.ca, for written versions of some of what we talk about on air and an awesome archive full of 8 years of breaking stories and busting balls all over the university.
On today's show, we have our weekly roundup with UBC Features editor Arno Rosenfeld. In the second segment, we'll have an interview with Professor Hannah Whitman, the academic director of the UBC Farm. And after that, Neil and I will debrief and ask the question, is UBC a food desert?
To start things off, we've got Arno Rosenfeld in the studio with us here today. Arno is a fourth-year political science student and also the features editor of the UBC. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Arno, you wrote the cover story for last week's paper, which was about a half-leaked, half-discovered seismic report at UBC. Basically, you reported that UBC has 22 buildings in the very high-risk category, which would experience a full or partial collapse in the event of a moderate earthquake. What can you tell us about reporting that story?
Well, it was interesting because I came about it sort of by accident. I filed an FOI request with the province in relation to UBC during the week that Toop resigned and Gupta took over. And I was looking through some of the stuff, and there was nothing about Gupta, but there was a letter from Toop to Premier Clark, and he referenced that the campus had a number of buildings that were unsafe and that they wanted money from the province to fix it. And it mentioned these 30-some-odd buildings that there was risk of loss of life if there was an earthquake. And I said, well, that seems like a story. And I asked for the report from a few different offices, and all of those offices came back and said, we don't know what report you're talking about. Risk management told me explicitly that they had no idea what report I was talking about, even after I referenced the date and how I found it and sent them screenshots of the letter. A few days later, Public Affairs got in touch with me and said, we found the report. Come get it from us. What Public Affairs said is that we'll give you the report, but we only want to give it to you at what they called a technical briefing, which was a little bit pompous. They said, you know, I had to get the report in person at this meeting with the infrastructure and risk management guys, so Ron Holton in risk management and John Metris in infrastructure. And I asked them why. They were pretty transparent about it. They said they wanted to be able to frame it in, you know, a way that was favorable to the university as opposed to just giving us a report and letting us do what we would with it.
Well, I'm sure it's a mixture of trying to be helpful to give context to it as well as we don't trust you.
I think they had some weird fear that I was going to take this report and publish a story with no sources, because of course I wanted to interview Metris and Holton, but I wanted the report before I interviewed them so that I could talk to engineers, get some context for what the report meant, and ask them intelligent questions. And I sat down at the meeting with the two of them, and they're like, so what do you want to talk about? I was like, I don't know because I don't have the report yet. So they walked me through it, and they were helpful, and I think they were earnest, but it was an annoying PR move, definitely.
So let's get to the actual substance of the story. Do you want to highlight some buildings that are particularly high risk?
Macmillan, I believe. The Kenny building, the entire psychology department is at high risk. So, you know, you're talking about classroom blocks that are pretty multi-purpose and office buildings, you know, the Lacerre building, for example. And some of these buildings, they have specific plans to move the students into new buildings, and the other ones, they don't. I mean, and I think those are the buildings that are the most concerning. There are other buildings like greenhouses and like Thunderbird Stadium where the odds of anybody being in them and injured are pretty low. But there are three or four buildings that, you know, have occupancy over a few hundred students and are at pretty max occupancy. So if there was an earthquake during the school day, it'd be about 7,000 people who would be in structures that are seismically unsound.
I'll mention again my favorite phrase from their report, which was that Macmillan has a significant lack of walls.
I don't know. Are you expecting any sort of follow-up? Now this is a bit more transparent than it used to be, but UBC doesn't have the money to be renovating all of these buildings all at once, which is fair enough, I guess.
The university is doing a better job than the rest of the province, which I felt a little bit bad with the mainstream media picking up on this and saying, you know, why isn't UBC doing more? Because nobody's doing very much. And so I think the university, they've done a few innovative things with funding to get more money into it. And I think within the next 10 years, we'll see a lot of improvement in terms of the number of high occupancy buildings that will be made seismically safe. But for the lower occupancy buildings, yeah, they're probably going to be on campus for the next 30 or 40 years.
All right. What's the next thing you want to talk about, Mayan?
Well, I was excited that there's a new grocery store in the new sub/nest.
No, new sub.
New sub. We're old school here. So yay, food. There hasn't ever been a grocery store in the center of campus.
As someone who spends too much time in the new sub, what are your thoughts, Arno?
I'm a huge fan. I saw it open and I was a little bit skeptical because, you know, the prices of all these restaurants on the new sub have gone up. And I assumed it was going to be like airport prices, but the prices are reasonable, maybe slightly marked up. But I mean, I got a Greek salad there the other day for, I think, like $4. And I'm actually really excited. Like, I think this is a game changer that might end up being
the implication that nowhere else sells actual food.
Nowhere else, right? Because like Shoppers doesn't sell like fresh groceries. And so if you want to be able to grab something on campus to take home and cook, it's much easier. Otherwise, you have to, I guess, go to Westbrook Village has Save-On, but otherwise there's nowhere convenient.
I mean, my question is, why is it so small? Maybe they assume that people don't cook, but it seems crazy that on a campus of 50,000 people, you wouldn't be able to have a normal-sized freaking grocery store. And Neil and I might have a little rant about grocery stores and other kinds of services that should be on University Boulevard but aren't planned to be. So we'll talk about that later.
Speaking of food, there is also a report from the newspaper about people getting sick at the Harvest Feast. What can you tell us about that? Were you there?
I swung by. I had a friend who was volunteering, but I didn't want to buy a ticket, so I didn't go inside. But I went by the tent, and you know, I saw them setting up, and I was like, oh, this is one of these fancy donor events. And I thought it was cool that it was not and that it was open to everybody.
Yeah, it's 1,000 people.
Yeah, it was a very classy setup, but I thought there was just something horribly ironic about, you know, the centennial feast being plagued by food poisoning.
Awkward. Anyways, but speaking of the Centennial Harvest Feast, so the Centennial is officially kicking off. We've already declared our disdain, I guess, for the multiple Centennials that UBC has seen fit to celebrate, but I guess this is the most legit Centennial.
Stephen Toop was on campus today, invited back for the Centennial, I think.
Can't believe I missed that.
Yeah, we actually tried to nab him for an interview, but no luck so far.
I have a lot of questions for him, actually. I've been wanting him to comment on the Scoopta stuff. I know he won't say much of interest, but I'd love to get his two cents.
Well, so he's gadding around with Martha Piper and with Bijan Amarian. At least that's what we've gleaned from Twitter.
What Centennial events is everyone looking forward to?
Honestly, I don't even know what's on the agenda. I know they, like, retook some sort of great track photo, which sounds cheesy.
Charles Menzies on Twitter was going on a rant about how it was a reenactment of colonial occupation, which was top form Menzies.
Which silly events are you looking forward to?
Yeah, what do you want to celebrate about the Centennial?
Avoiding it, mostly, I think. I guess I'm not a very proud alum.
It's not directly related to the Centennial, but UBC needs to pick a font, they need to pick colors, they need consistent brand. I mean, not that I want to promote UBC's brand, but it's almost absurd the number of hoodies that they sell in the bookstore. They've got to have the worst branding of any university. So I'm hoping that this will sort of be an impetus to get a unified image of like what the university is going to be, what the logo is going to be, what the colors are going to be. I would like to be an engaged alum, but at this point I have no interest in staying part of the community.
But Arno, you need a unified sweatshirt to get you to be an engaged alum? Really?
I think you need a unified image. Do you think people on campus consider themselves Thunderbirds? It's like you're here, you have your group of friends, but in terms of campus community, there's almost nothing. And I think that having a unified sense of what this university is, what it has in common, and I think those things are absolutely aided by a color scheme and a hoodie selection that matches up with that, as silly as it sounds.
Okay, so we're hoping that the Centennial is going to give us some decent goddamn branding for UBC.
Okay, let's talk about the board meeting that happened this Tuesday, and it was in Kelowna, so no one here was there, but the UBC sent some people. Arno?
Yeah, Moira, our intrepid news editor, went, and she was tweeting out from the meeting, and there was a presentation on wine growing. The presentation was, I don't know, probably related to wanting more money. And Kenneth Fung, one of the BOG members who's been in various sort of silly, weird scandals, wanted to know why BC Bud was so much better known than BC Wine, to which the director of the program said, quote, "I don't know how to answer that question." He also mentioned, on an unrelated note, that the Chinese consulate has been warning Chinese students about safety on UBC's campus, to which Louise Cowan appeared flustered and asked him to please talk to her about this after the meeting so that they could do something practical. But those were his two main contributions.
This is the same Kenneth Fung who, at the committee's meeting when they were talking about the biosciences building, was asking questions in a way that made it seem clear that he thought it was a place where a whole bunch of chemical and biological weapons would be stored.
Honestly, having never heard of this guy or seen him or met him before in my life, I kind of like him. Like, I just think he's probably refreshingly honest about his ignorance. Sometimes an excessive truth is too much for us to handle.
Well, it does provide some kind of comic relief on a board of governors that is very dry. So Moira does a good job of bringing out the bits of humor and entertainment that come up at these meetings.
Yeah, Moira definitely has the live tweeting skills down to a fine art. She's amazing. Well, we'll wrap up news there. Thanks to Arno Rosenfeld for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks so much for having me.
In studio with my co-host Neil Janssen, and you're listening to UBC Insiders On Air, broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Our guest this week is Hannah Whitman, the academic director of the Center for Sustainable Food Systems, otherwise known as the UBC Farm. Dr. Whitman is an associate professor, and she's cross-appointed at the Faculty of Land and Food Systems and at the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability, which is also my home department. Welcome to the show, Hannah.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't you tell us a bit about your background and how you ended up being the academic director at the farm?
Sure. So I grew up on a family farm in northern Idaho, fourth generation, farming various kinds of commodity grains, wheat, barley, lentils. We had some animals. And I always was interested in the idea of sustainability, how a family farm or any kind of farm could feed the world while also taking care of the environment around us.
And what does it mean that you're academic director? What is your role?
So my role is to facilitate the academic objectives related to the UBC farm and broadly to bring together faculty across UBC looking at sustainable food systems. So that means to facilitate research, to facilitate teaching opportunities, and also to facilitate community engagement with many of the food systems problems and challenges that our communities bring to us.
So the position of academic director didn't always exist at the UBC farm. When was that position created, and what is that symbolic of?
That's a really good question. So the UBC Farm has been sort of an active student-run organization since about the mid-2000s. And in 2011, you were part of that movement, Maya, the students, faculty, and community members got together and convinced the Board of Governors to rezone the farm as a green academic space. So that actually removed the farm from the Future Housing Reserve and created a vision and a mission to utilize that space for academic engagement around sustainable food systems research. At that point, the Center for Sustainable Food Systems was created, and the academic director position was created at that time.
And we'll pick up on what that transition from the Future Housing Reserve to the Green Academic means in a minute. But I still wanted to stay with the idea of balancing these academic goals with other goals that have to do with community and actual food production. And how do you see those coming together? Like, I find it interesting that in a way the UBC farm is an amenity to the rather expensive communities and this like yuppies that come and shop there. At the same time, maybe its primary goals are not that.
Right. That's a really good question. And people often ask me, well, why are we using university space to grow food? And my response to that is we grow food not just to grow food, but to use the practice and processes of growing food for teaching and learning. So students are involved in every aspect of the food production system. They're learning basic ecology. They're learning business management practices. We have an active social enterprise development at the UBC Farm. We're working with students from Sauder this semester to look at how you can have a social enterprise model where you're producing food, you're selling that food, but then you're reinvesting those earnings into community education and outreach.
And so to what degree does the farm sustain itself financially through these activities?
So just the sale of vegetables and fruits at the UBC Farm is about a quarter of the operating budget. About a third of our operating budget comes from research grants and community outreach grants. And we also have about 20% of our budget, which comes from fee-for-service educational opportunities. So, for example, today there's a large group of Vancouver School Board students at the farm. They pay a fee for that service to the farm.
So does that leave, what, like 10, 15% for outright funding from the university?
The UBC Farm receives 15% of its funding from the university. So
that's quite a contrast to what I remember when I think there was one salary that was funded by the Faculty of Land and Food Systems, and that was it.
Well, the UBC Farm is a very interesting social enterprise because unlike some of the other research institutes at UBC, we're 85% self-funded. So in that sense, we're trying to exercise financial responsibility and also to show the university that their investment is actually having quite large generative effects.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to the official transition of the UBC Farm and its establishment as a department that stands on solid ground. So in 2011, the designation of the farm was officially changed from this future housing reserve to the Green Academic. But that was done on the condition that the university's housing needs could be found elsewhere through a density transfer of the theoretical density that would have existed on the farm to other parts of the campus. So would you say that the farm is really safe from housing development given that stipulation?
So my understanding of the official land use plan for the university, and that's, I looked recently at the June 2015 version of that land use plan, the Green Academic zoning is a zoning that exists, and we're in there. Thunderbird Stadium is in there. Totem Field is in there, the Botanical Garden. And so these are areas that are zoned for academic output. And so as long as we can justify to the university that we are fulfilling our academic mandate, my understanding is that that land is safe from development.
And do you guys know if that Green Academic designation was created during this time of the struggle over the farm, or did it exist before that?
It was largely created not specifically for the farm, but as a designation to delineate the types of things that you're talking about. Academic uses of campus which are not heavy on buildings, let's say.
Yeah, the land use plan uses words like open green space. So that allows us to build a farm center. That's a small footprint building replacing existing structures on the property that would then enable us to expand our academic outreach.
Okay, so let's talk more about the farm center. The UBC farm has just bagged a big donation of $2 million from the founders of Nature Path Foods. Can you tell us about that relationship and what the money is going to be used for?
Yes. So the co-owners and founders of Nature's Path, Aaron and Rotana Stevens, are community members. Aaron Stevens grew up on a small family farm on Vancouver Island, and he has also really been interested in the idea of sustainable and organic agriculture. So they have grown from a small family business to one of the largest organic food processors in North America. And their foods apparently now go to 50 countries, which I find amazing. So they have been supporters of the farm for a long time. They live quite near UBC and sort of have witnessed the transformation of the farm from a space used by the community to a space not only used by the community, but extending into our academic programming. And so they very generously have donated this donation to build our farm center. So their gift is earmarked for the construction of the farm center, which will have laboratories, classrooms, and some common space for academic outreach.
And a brewery, I hear.
So the AMS, as you may know, in January 2014 passed a referendum to support the development of a brewery on campus. And the current negotiation between the UBC Farm and the AMS is to have that brewery be part of what we're calling a food and beverage processing laboratory. If you think of the concept of the Farm Center as a field-to-fork research laboratory, you have growing hops on the farm. We could even grow barley. We could grow some of the other ingredients for beer and other kinds of beverages. And then you can process those and you can study fermentation practices and that sort of thing.
Nice. And was that brewery originally meant to be in the sub?
My understanding is that the original proposal that it was going to be part of the sub.
I think that was a fairly short-lived idea. Once they actually started examining what it would take to get it in the sub, it was just some idea that someone threw out there. And then it was probably deemed unrealistic fairly early on.
I think the beer will be brought to the sub.
Okay.
But it sounds like it's going to be a very low volume operation.
Yeah, there will not be a pub at the farm. The idea is that craft breweries could actually participate in projects at the farm. So they often need help with testing new varieties of beer, testing new brewing processes. And then also there could be a small-scale commercial brewery that would both provide funding for our ongoing academic mandate, but then also be a partnership with the AMS for their interests and needs.
So when is the new building and this brewery meant to be finished?
That's a good question. We're in an active fundraising campaign right now. We're about a quarter of the way to what we need for the building as a whole.
Oh, so the $2 million is not enough?
Oh, no. It's a very good start, though. We also have $1 million from the Real Estate Foundation, and then we also have $1 million from the RBC Bank's Blue Water Fund. So those are our sort of foundational donors with the AMS, and then we're looking towards our broader community to support the rest of the fundraising.
Okay. Some of us that have been around for a while, I think, looked askance at the UBC press release that was talking about that big donation. For me, it was a mixture of happiness about it on the one hand and kind of cynicism about it. And the happiness is because it's cool to see UBC's institutional support so solidly behind the farm. But the cynicism comes in where in the press release it says that the UBC farm was saved in 2010, but doesn't mention why it needed to be saved or who it was saved from. And I was just wondering how you see that change and the tune that UBC is playing around the UBC farm.
So I wasn't at UBC during that campaign. I've been here 3 years. My interpretation of what I've come to understand about the history of that mobilization is it was basically a huge victory and an indication of institutional change. There was a lack of understanding about what the UBC farm's aims were, and there was also a lack of communication about what the potential was. And that actually shifted when the group of students, faculty, and community members got together and wrote Cultivating Place, which was the academic vision for the UBC farm, which was ultimately the planning document that was used to make the case to the Board of Governors to change the zoning. And so it's interesting to me to watch that institutional change happen. You don't often see an institution as large and as immobile as a university actually do basically a 180 to support what students and faculty have been called for. So I was actually really excited. I was not at UBC at the time to see that happen. And I think it's an indication of the ability of the students to communicate and also the ability of the administration at that time to sort of say, okay, we recognize now that this has potential and we're willing to put our support behind it.
I mean, one interpretation of that is that it's a positive institutional change. But the other interpretation is that the administration had to be dragged kicking and screaming to the right direction after a lot of conflict. And then that planning document that you mentioned was only written after that, essentially, after the GVRD had written a letter to UBC, essentially kind of scolding them for not having responded already.
Yeah. Well, institutional change, it usually requires a lot of kicking and screaming, no matter what. I mean, institutional change in any institution is slow, and I think that it's rare that an institutional change like that happens in a conflict-free environment. So I don't think that that's unusual. That said, I still think the fact that it happened is positive.
And I'll add a bit of background from the planning point of view. The farm had previously been designated as Future Housing Reserve, and so it wasn't guaranteed to become housing. The way Future Housing Reserved in the old official community plan was described is that it may become housing if it's not needed for academic activities. And so the board basically tried to have it both ways there, where they decided that it was useful for academic activities, but they still wanted the housing.
Right, and they spent all sorts of time trying to, like, delineate what was academic and what wasn't on the farm and trying to sort of dissect out the different uses, which, of course, was impossible because of the nature of how the farm works and all the mixtures of interesting uses that go on there. But, yeah, I agree with you that the ultimate outcome is a really good thing.
And one thing on the overall future of the farm, a few years ago I wrote a piece asking, should the farm be in the ALR, the... What does that stand for?
Agricultural Land Reserve.
Okay. And what inspired that at the time was UBC had acquired some land at UBC Okanagan, which was in the ALR, and I proposed that maybe they should swap it. Basically, they could get their land in the Okanagan out of it and put the UBC farm in it. Is that a realistic idea, or am I completely out to lunch?
You know, this is not the first time that this has come up, and it's something that I do research on land zoning practices. It's on my agenda this fall to look into how and if that could possibly work. My initial and very superficial understanding is that it would be very difficult to put the UBC farm into the housing reserve, that the green academic zoning is actually a zoning that protects the UBC farm from development. Whether or not we could put it in the agricultural land reserve, I think, remains to be seen. But I think the spirit of agricultural use is already there. And I also don't think we should take land out of the agricultural reserve in the Okanagan.
Okay, fair enough. I think we will wrap it up on that note.
No questions about the harvest feast?
Oh. Although I heard it was the chicken.
Wait, but so Hannah, what happened at the harvest feast?
So I was actually out of town for the harvest feast. I have heard that there was some food safety concern, and I do actually know that Vancouver Coastal Health came out to the UBC farm yesterday, and we passed our food safety inspection with flying colors, so it wasn't us.
And I guess we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us in this interview. It was great to hear more about what's going on with the farm.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Anna.
Having trouble finding affordable fresh baked goods and coffee? Come down to Agora Cafe located in the McMillan building at UBC. There's also space available to study.
Well, I found Hannah to be remarkably concise. Do you have any other ideas about the farm and where it's going?
Not really. I have to admit I haven't been out there in quite a while. I sometimes drop by the farm market that they hold. I guess I'm one of those yuppies that they serve, but I don't usually buy things because it is pretty pricey.
Yeah, actually, one of the questions I forgot to ask her was what the most sort of accessible, cheap way for UBC students is to access food from the farm. I mean, I used to volunteer there quite a bit in 2007-08, and that was right before the sort of major Save the Farm push came about. But that's still very much vivid in my memory, the struggle. And Hannah's coming into the position without that vivid memory because she was hired on to UBC more recently. And in a way, that's a good thing since it's her job to move forward. But just looking at the arc of the story, for me, it's like a kind of fable, whether it's institutional change or kind of getting dragged, kicking and screaming away from terrible ideas and then turning around and taking credit for the outcome. I'm okay with the outcome, but why does UBC have to operate this way? Like, there must be a better way.
Well, it's the revisionist history angle of it. Yeah, we don't like when they pretend like history didn't happen the way it happened.
Right. Maybe we'll stick with the food theme. Neil, there's a piece in the UBC Insider's draft folder that you've been working on for a while. And because of the new grocery store opening and the UBC Farm segment, we thought today might be a good day to chat about it, which basically has to do with looking at the number of grocery stores that exist in the UBC environs and asking, is UBC a food desert?
I think it is. I've run the fairly preliminary numbers, and this was just a very brute force data analysis where I simply counted up all the grocery stores that exist in all the jurisdictions in the Metro Vancouver area and then compared it to their population. Across the Metro Vancouver region, it's about one grocery store per 10,000 people. And I should mention these are like full grocery stores. But what's happening at UBC is that our population is increasing quite significantly, and there's basically no chance that we're going to get another substantial grocery store on campus ever. So once campus build-out happens, and even sooner, let's say in about 5 to 10 years, campus will be drastically underserved simply on a grocery stores per capita level.
Why is it out of the question that we should have another grocery store? There's the University Boulevard development plan, which is supposed to bring more commercial uses to the ground floor of a bunch of mixed-use buildings there. So why can't one of those be a grocery store that would up our average?
I don't know, frankly. All I know is that UBC has no plans to put another substantial grocery store on campus. Basically, their position is that Save-On is there, and isn't that good enough? Interestingly enough, I was at another meeting where a Properties Trust employee was talking about if you want to have a successful mixed-use commercial center, you basically need three anchor tenants. One is a grocery store, one is a liquor store, and one is a pharmacy. And so that's happening in Westbrook Place. They've got all three, or will soon have all three. But they're trying to do the same thing in University Boulevard, have a successful mixed-use center. And while we have the Shoppers, the lease that Mahoney's has prevents a liquor store from ever being allowed to have a tenancy here. And of course, they have no plans to build a grocery store beyond the relatively small one that's in the new sub. The main challenge is simply the amount of square feet that a grocery store requires.
I mean, what comes to mind for me is these new kinds of grocery stores that have been popping up in Germany that are really innovative and they minimize packaging. They have sort of everything in bulk, and it's more like fresh stuff in bins or bringing your own containers for the manufactured stuff. And I think UBC should look into that, and I don't think it would take up all that much space. You could just, like, convert one of the gimmicky, God knows what they're called, collegiums or startup spaces, i.e. rooms with computers in them, and turn it into a grocery store that, you know, would serve thousands of people that live and work on this campus every single day.
Well, that's our show. I'm Neil Janssen, and you've been listening to UBC Insiders On Air. We now have a SoundCloud RSS feed that you can use to subscribe to the podcast, which will hopefully push updates automatically to you with whatever podcast app you use. We'll post a link on our site that you can use to put the RSS feed in your podcast app. We're still working on getting the podcast onto iTunes and updated in the CITR website. Hopefully both those things will happen soon. You can also follow us on Twitter at UBC Insiders and email us. We're both very easy to find on Google. Thanks to Arno Rosenfeld and Hannah Whitman for joining us today. And as always, thank you, Mayan.
Thanks, Neil, and we'll talk to you all next week. We will be interviewing Joanne Fox, who's the head of Vantage College, and she'll be setting us straight on all the bad press they've got.
Can't wait. Insider's Edge.